Okay, we're continuing the interview of Douglas First, and now this is tape 34. Okay.
Okay, then there, all Congresses have a big banquet, and so when it came to the banquet, and usually I've always been, you know, put up towards the front, etc. When we got there, our table was clear at the back by the elevator. I mean, clear at the back. And I, with a few unknowns and a couple of students, and that was all obviously all deliberate. Really very deliberate. And I was sitting beside somebody from Czechoslovakia and trying to talk. His English was extremely marginal. So then I thought, well, I could talk with him in German, although I had, you know, I could do fairly well, but I learned German for speaking later than that one. But as soon as we switched to German, you know, God, he went to 90 miles an hour in German, you know, whereas he would just searching for words in English. So anyway, we were able to carry on a conversation, but this thing of sticking us way back by the entryway door, I mean the door to where they brought the food in, it was very deliberate. Another one of the Congresses, I think was probably 75, I always looked at the tours afterwards. More recently, I sort of quit that, but the meeting was in Sardinia, and...
Now, I'm confused. If they were every 10 years...
No.
Every 2 years.
2 to 3.
2 to 3. Okay. All right.
I've skipped...
Right.
I've
sure, but I...
Down to sometimes 2 years, and then it went from 60, there was 1 year between 63, 64, and then it was 4 years to the Russian. Then I think the Czechs wanted to show that, hey, we're still alive. That was put in 70. Then there was one in 73, and then the Italians had one in 75.
That was Sardinia.
Very well-known professor, Mario Carta, who was the representative to the Congresses from Italy, was the chairman. And so it was in Sardinia. And I went on the excursion to Morocco, and Morocco produces, you know, Europe's major source of phosphate. Obviously, it must have been submerged under the sea in very high-grade phosphate ore. And so we visited a couple of the phosphate operations, which they just dig it out and put it on. I mean, that's virtually all they do. I don't think they have to upgrade it or anything. Just beautiful, beautiful stuff. But we were in Casablanca, which is a nothing place, got a great sounding name. But we then went to Marrakesh. Mm-hmm. And we were in Marrakesh over May 1st. And so that's a holiday. And all of the Europeans, those from Norway, etc., they spent the day around the swimming pool. But somebody who was the vice president of Kalikemi in Germany, potash producer and phosphate fertilizer producer, they made fertilizer. He and I rented a car and drove up over the Atlas Mountains out into the Sahara on that day. Mm. And that, you know, it was a great excursion. The Atlas are the kind of mountains that the bighorns are. They just poke up and get quite high.
Wait.
Is that a cement mixer?
Yeah, it sounds like something that they're just moving along.
okay. We went on up over the, out onto the, into the Sahara and visited a couple of kasbahs and things like that, that's the part I really remember of it. And then afterwards, I went to Rome and spent a day or so at the Mineral Processing Institute there, and was very nicely, beautifully treated by them. I'm glad I did that. That sort of cemented my relations. And as a matter of fact, let me just go ahead. The director of that by this time was Professor Rinelli, Giorgio Rinelli, R-I-N-E-L-L-I. I think Professor Usoni had died, and Rinelli.
I don't know if we're going to get this at all.
I just can't.
Well, it's fading away now, whatever it is.
I don't know what they're doing. I don't see anything. It's almost as if.
Sounds as if they're.
It's not like a ball mill, but it can't do that. And
well, it's faded away a little now.
It
so
must be because.
I think we're okay.
Yeah. So, anyway.
This mic is so sensitive, it picks up everything.
Anyway, Rinelli later became the Italian scientific attaché to the U.S. And I remember having dinner at his place in Washington. I think he was there 2 or 4 years as their scientific attaché. And then after that, I think he served the same role in Spain for the Italians, and left, and then afterwards the director of this institute was Anna Marabini, who I think I've already mentioned. If not, she came later, although she was there, but became the director later. Let me just stop. I want to. There was a congress in São Paulo, and Matt Arbiter had, I think, had replaced Russ Spedden as the American member of the steering committee and scientific committee of the mineral processing congresses. And he was there in São Paulo, but had to leave a bit early, so he asked me to sit in, and which I did. And then he decided to step down and said that I should be his replacement. And it turns out that the person appointed should be appointed by the technical society of the country. And lo and behold, and I think Spedden had appointed Arbiter. Arbiter appointed me, but the SMEAIME appointed Roshan Bapu. And Bapu had never once been to a Congress before, since, or after. And so somebody got that promptly changed to where I was named that person, and so I held that role till 1977, till 1997, I guess, and then I decided to resign, in my old age, to step down. But what was interesting is there always was this balance to make sure between East Europe and West Europe, or U.S. and Russia. I didn't look at this as any political thing, but I could see how the Europeans did it. And they wanted to, make sure there was always a balance, and that, that there were so many Russians at a thing, there were so many Americans, and Westerners and so on. And as a result, some, maybe it's 15 years ago or so by now, the general reorganized the organization, Mineral Processing Congresses, so that there would be an I would call him executive secretary, who's Professor Forsberg from Luleå, and he made a very good choice because Sweden is, first of all, is very able, and Sweden was a neutral, neutral in relation to east, west, north, and south, right? And so Forsberg, I think, has taken on, he's in the middle maybe of his second 10-year term of that. But it's really the one person that kind of supplies the cohesion, let's say,
Well, now, what's the level of scientific accomplishment about the same between the two spheres? Technical accomplishment.
At a lot of these congresses, there's always a lot of input that's not really first rate.
But it was a political division rather than a technical one.
No, the political division was in the minds of the Europeans, I think. Because, for example, the Russian, both Russian representatives that I recall clearly were big people. One is a very outstanding man, Professor Bogdanov, Bogdanov. And I remember they was, quite a few years ago, sent me a wire asking me to write a letter on congratulations on his 80th birthday. But Bogdanov was a good man, from a research director, let's say, of the big Russian research institute in Leningrad called Mekanober, Mekhanobr. And Mekhanobr did all of the research for all, and engineering for all of the non-ferrous mines of Russia. They were organized that way. And then for a number of years was a fairly young man, Retsinov, Retsinov. And I know he was what was called a corresponding member of their Academy of Sciences, which meant he was a very good man. And he became the representative, but he was also the director of Mekhanobr. But at age 54, had a heart attack and died. Just bang on. He, as the years went by, his English became really quite good, so he must have worked pretty hard at it, whereas early on his English was not particularly great. But see, early on some of all these congresses, Vladimir Mabera was always at these meetings, and he seemed to be acting as an interpreter to the Russians, because first of all he's technical, but his English was very good. So anyway, I did that, and then we had a congress in San Francisco in 1995, and I did not want to be the chairman. Always the member would be the chairman of the meeting, but I just didn't want to undertake all the responsibility and all the requirements of being chairman of the meeting. And my former student, John Herbst, was the general chair. I served on the executive committee, and I think worked up the program selection, and Peg was chairman of the accompanying persons program and stuff like that. And then the last meeting after that was in Aachen in Germany, and at that point I said, I wanted to, step down, I'd done it 20 years.
It's a long time. And so on.
But there's only one, every country can have a member of the scientific committee, but only countries that have had a Congress have a member of the steering committee. So the steering committee is the one that meets and selects where the next Congress will be. For example, in Rome, it was very formal presentations, and in fact I was responsible for going to Rome. The Brits thought they deserved it, but I kind of pushed it. And well, the Romans, Italians, were very appreciative of the fact that I got the 2000 Congress for them in Rome. And the next one will be in 2003 in South Africa, Cape Town. Mm-hmm. And I think the one after that is probably Turkey, I think I've heard. And I'm assuming I still might be going to Congresses then. But these are quite formal presentations made. You know, obviously the Chinese are working on one. And those are the mineral processing congresses that are I think, very important and play a very international role. But I've been to a few, let's call it mineral processing meetings in some countries, and I'll just tell you about two or three of these. One was 1973. It was the, I think it was called the second South American Symposium on Extractive Metallurgy, and I'd been invited in Santiago. And I talked to many people about should we go or should I went myself, should I go there? Including a professor here who had just come back, and he gave me his Chilean money, which was worth pennies. I had a former student who had done a PhD with me working for Exxon. Maybe he was at Amex at the time. I called him up and discussed whether I should go. But it was a went, and flew down there.
When was this?
August 1973, late end of August, towards the end of August. And so anyway, it was a good meeting, and Andy Mular, who had been a student of mine here, professor now University of British Columbia, and one of his colleagues, George Poling, the three of us flew down together. I don't know that there are any other Americans that I can recall. There might have been, but not of the academic type. And so anyway, the meeting, was uneventful. But one thing that you could see were long, long lines. And ask, well, what's it for? Well, that line there is, I mean, lines go around the block for toothpaste, or lines go around the block for cooking oil, somebody said. And another thing I remember is when they bought a bottle of wine, they always felt under the wrapping around the cork, because if there was a chip, you couldn't take the bottle back if it was chipped. You go and get a bottle of wine if you took a bottle back. This was, when Allende was there. Mm-hmm. Okay, so anyway, we had a trip up to El Teniente, and which used to be Braden Copper, as you know. Mm-hmm. And anyway, as I remember, there were seven parallel circuits in the mill. And two of them were just dead rusted, nothing. In other words, they'd been shut down for a long time. And another one was down. So there were only four of seven mines running in that big mill, which was in, at that time, the really outstanding engineers of Chile had left when Allende came in. And so Codelco was not staffed with great leadership. Codelco today is first rank. The Chilean engineers are really first rank.
Was Haldeman there?
Probably no Americans. They was already all, mm-hmm. they'd been taken over by the Chilean. They had a huge copper smelter, so they're either putting in this Outokumpu process, great big furnace, I think was just being built, a massive furnace in the smelter. So this is August, so what's that? That's kind of winter. I remember it's kind of cold up there, mm-hmm. up at the mine and the smelter.
How high is El Teniente?
My guess, I'll just pull out of the air, 7,000 feet. Mm-hmm. It's not one of those 14,000 some of those, like, Escondida and stuff, I think, are very, very high. Anyway, things were extremely cheap because inflation was so bad that people traded their Chilean money into dollars. Mm. And you almost felt bad at their exchange rate, but what they did is then when they wanted to buy something, they would then turn those dollars back to Chilean money. Mm-hmm. I'm just speaking ordinary people. It wasn't surreptitious. I would have mm-hmm. never changed money in Russia. But anyway, maybe the actual cost might have been 10%. Because of this horrendous inflation. Mm. I remember taking some Chilean friends to dinner. I think the dinner for four of us cost me only $10 for a big fancy dinner. I bought a lot of blankets and stuff, or these capes, whatever the cowboys wear, which we use up in the mountains to this day. For nothing, because of that exchanger. Anyway, got back 4 days later. They bombed Allende, so right where the hotel was and that whole thing is right because the government palace was on this square, and it was all bombed out right across from the hotel. And some Japanese were. Who were at this this symposium? Were up what was that big old Anaconda mine? Famous mine, still going. I'll get the name.
Okay. Near.
Oh, it's up in the.
Copiapó. Well, Chuki is.
It might have been Chuki Kamada. It probably was Chuki. If not, it was the other one that Anaconda had two of them. Let's say it'll come to me later. Anyway, they were there on a field trip during right after the bombing had taken place, mm. and they couldn't leave, you know, for a couple of weeks because of that, you know, because that was the time of this rebellion. Mm-hmm. So all of my apprehension was really right. I mean, to mm-hmm. left just 4 days before that took place. Mm-hmm. And I don't recall what led up to my apprehension, but it must have been in the paper a lot. I want to come back to our visit to El Teniente and the copper smelter. There was a famous Australian person who, I'll get his first name, last name Warner, W-O-R-N-E-R, and he developed a smelting process on CRA, which is now at Rio Tinto. Always name processes or machinery after the inventor. And I saw a flotation cell made by somebody named Davis. They called it Davcra cell. So there's a Warcra smelting process. So this man, Warner, was on this visit up to El Teniente, and we were in the smelter, and we were in the room where they were taking molten copper and casting it into anodes. It's, you know, it's a big wheel with these forms that they make the copper anodes, you know, about that thick and so big, and copper splattering all over. And I remember Warner saying, he stroked his chin a bit, and he says, you know, I think they're getting 85% recovery on the casting wheel.
Oh.
That's funny. Anyway, that trip in the long run was kind of, in essence, uneventful. But this was 73. In 77 was another meeting that, you know, flotation really started about 1905 in Australia. And it started at the Timber Butte Mill at Butte in 1911. So that's, you know, in this country. Mm-hmm. But really, flotation started in Germany in 1877 with two brothers had a graphite operation, Bessel's brothers, B-E-S-S-E-L, and I think it may or may not have an S on the end of it, Bessel, maybe without the S, I'll look it up. And they floated, they ground the graphite ore and then boiled it, and so they made the bubbles out of steam, and then the steam bubbles, you know, graphite's due to its surface structure is hydrophobic, and water repellent, and so they recovered the graphite by flotation. So in one sense, that really, to the Germans, that's the beginning of flotation, but whereas
you had to boil it.
Well, that's how they were getting their bubbles. Mm-hmm. Didn't occur to them, I guess, to blow in air. If they had, they would have. So anyway, the Germans east in Freiberg had a symposium on the 100th anniversary of flotation, and I was invited there. I think I was the only American. And so that one involved and then very famous, outstanding professor, Schubert, S-C-H-U-B-E-R-T, was in charge of the meeting, so I had to go to Berlin, you know, to go into East Germany, and he drove up there to meet me, and he said to go to a certain gate, and I went there, took a taxi there. Of course, I couldn't cross, and then he was on the other side on the telephone and said, I gave you the wrong thing, you have to go to Checkpoint Charlie. And so I, you know, walked out, found a taxi, and got to Checkpoint Charlie, and I'll tell you, that was very apprehensive going through there, because the East Germans are snarly, and whatnot. And
they tried to intimidate.
Oh yeah, and even the persons you know in the immigration type spot, you know, they sneer and snarl and whatnot. And anyway, as I say, with apprehension, I went through there. But on the other side was Professor Schubert, and so he showed me around a little bit about East Berlin, and boy, you only got about one block. See, the wall was up by then, of course, and because I'd been up a long time already, and you just go about two blocks in, and it obviously looked about like it did at the end of World War II. They had not rebuilt it. A lot of damaged buildings and so forth and so on, and we had ate in a restaurant when the food was nothing to write home about, etc. And then we drove down to Freiburg, where they held this meeting, and which was to me very interesting. And then he afterwards, you know, we drove around, went to Dresden one day. Dresden's right nearby. And then the palace was all blown apart. There was a Lutheran church that they made a monument out of that was just a pile of rubble. And opera house was still rubble and so on. By the way, they had a congress in Dresden in 91, and that opera house had been rebuilt. The palace was being redone, and this church, they had numbered every block and brick, and they were going to rebuild this church. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking of earlier there was this rubble in the statue of Martin Luther. Mm-hmm. So it shows you, you know, what the Germans are doing to bring things back. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that turned out to be a very interesting meeting without great apprehension, except that here in the streets of Freiburg, and you know, nothing painted, you know, stuff like that in those days. But there was the cathedral there was all oriented towards mining, and you could see, you know, the statues of medieval miners and so on held up the pulpit. Wonderful. As I remember, but you know, here it was about the end of June, I got cold that got deep into my chest, and when I got back, I was told by the doctor at Pfizer I had pneumonia, and he said, "You got the real thing." And so I remember my daughter Lucy was graduating high school, and I couldn't go to the high school commencement from that. This was in 78, Maury and I were invited to go to South Africa. They have what they call a winter course. And so we went down there, and it's a one-week course where engineers and so on come from all over South Africa under the auspices of the South African Institute of Mining and Metallurgy. And this was in Johannesburg. And so few of the lectures were given by South Africans. He and I planned it. We planned it too much. But I think I gave about 8 of the lectures, and maybe Maury about 7. We did a lot of it. It ended up a book, which was published edited by Peter King, who's been now many years, quite a few years, University of Utah. But, you know, that was a, it's a good book. And, but go to South Africa, you're in the days when you couldn't sell things here, you know, 78. But afterwards, we, and that had maybe 100, 120, 150 people. It turned out to be a very good course. There were lectures, and I think they had some workshops maybe in the afternoon, and maybe some labs, which we didn't participate. But then we had 1 week where we visited big. Have you been to Johannesburg?
I've never been to South Africa.
So,
I'd love to
at that time, the city had mountains in it, and these mountains were big tailings piles. I mean, quite high, probably a couple hundred feet high, and flat on the top, of course, and large. And then the roads went around them and so on. But what they were doing was pulping these tailings, and they had they built a big mill. We were in this one mill, which was very new. In fact, they had just opened it, treating 50, 60,000 or maybe more tons of tailings per day by flotation, leaching and flotation. What they wanted to do is get the uranium out of these tailings and the pyrite.
Now, they had been mined originally.
Oh, yeah, these are tailings from the gold mine.
From gold.
Yeah, and
but they had residual uranium.
And they needed uranium because they were under embargo, and they needed the sulfur for sulfuric acid. So they're floating pyrite and then trying to get their uranium recovered. Huge flotation machines. At the time, they were the biggest I'd ever seen. And they had a thickener that I think IMCO had put in there, which was the largest in the world, 400 feet in diameter. And this thickener, you could see white caps from the wind blowing. So we visited several other mills, another new mill that was just being finished, and Bechtel was building it, and it was different than the construction up at McLaughlin, in that Bechtel had a big room which was just full of blueprints. I mean, thousands of blueprints hanging on racks. So everything was drawn and in those days, this would be 78 for this entire plant. And, you know, by the time they did McLaughlin, they more or less made models, and then they would just use the model to design where the pipes go and so on. So anyway, we found that very fascinating. Then Maury and I flew up, spent 3 days in Kruger Park, which where all the animals are. Kruger Park is as big as Massachusetts, and we were there in August, so the grass was brown, and so the animals were
brown too.
Oh, plenty of, you could see them. Mm-hmm. Our guide said the typical Germans will come in their winter, which is South African summer. He said the grass is 3 feet high and you don't see the animal. But we saw, you know, lions and giraffes, elephants, antelope by the millions, and hippopotamus. The only thing we didn't see was a leopard. Our guide had talked with his colleague, and the colleague went on one road, we went on another, and he said there was a leopard up and resting in a tree on the other road. But it was, we were there. Three-day tour, which was very good, just in a VW bus. But we visited Pella Bora, which was the big copper mine of then owned in some measure by Newmont. And they had two of the world's, that time, biggest SAG mills, and one of them had a crack in it. It was misdesigned. you know, by Topper's company in this country, and and the Shell couldn't take the load. And at that time, it was, you know, they were fighting the crack in it, and I guess eventually they got a new mill and sort of split the huge cost of replacement. But apparently it was not designed right structurally. And then, by the way, we visited, had quite a tour. There's a little bit of, they recover some uranium, vanadium there out of that ore too. I remember seeing that. And then there's about 10% of it is magnetite, which is magnetic iron oxide, but it runs about 3% titanium. But they decided to remove the magnetite because all they do is pass it through a magnetic separator. And so here was this massive, and I mean maybe a mile long and, you know, block wide or half block wide, you know, pile of magnetite. And, you know, someday that may be valuable. But he said the engineer, those, our tour guide said that they had proposed selling this rather cheaply to the coal companies that use magnetite suspension to make a heavy fluid sink float the coal, float the coal and sink the slate. You know, to get a slurry of density, you know, 1.8 or somewhere in through there. But they wouldn't even take this magnetite because they wanted to, they've always used some other magnetite which was high grade, cost them money.
Oh.
That tells you sometimes the thought process in the industry. Anyway, we drove on out to see the tailings. And this tailings, oh, must have been
this is
2-3 miles across.
I mean,
it was big. And, so, and what they do is they build up the dam by cycloning take the tailings and pump it out through a cyclone, and then the sand coarse fraction comes out, and they use that to build the wall up of the tailings dam, and then the fines are just go on into the dam itself. So they, you know, like at Homestead, they call those the slimes, if you remember. Anyway, I always take pictures, and I never got this particular picture, but there was this big cyclone sitting there, and two baboons sitting there watching it. And this engineer said those baboons staying there all day, every day, watching that cyclone, because the underflow is kind of spiraling out the bottom, and they're fascinated by it. He said they sit and watch it all day. Anyway, at the far end where we got down, and there lived in the water a family of hippopotamuses.
Oh,
and so when you talk about environment, obviously it was...
They were enjoying
no problem. He said they'd been there for years. And they live in this the water part of the pond. Anyway, the tailings. Some of the tailings are then. I mean, they're split because the mine is adjacent to a big phosphate mine called Phoscor, which I think was a state-owned company. I know Godin spent a lot of time, I knew but didn't realize what it was, working on the flow sheet of Phoscor, to, you know, the flotation of this phosphate mineral. But apparently the two mines abut each other, and so what they must have worked out that Pelabora would mine the ore that was where they invited, and we'd get the copper out. And then those particular tailings were then pumped to Phosphor and then went on into the Phosphor flotation plant. And that was a big operation too. I just pulled out of the air, it might have been, you know, 50,000 tons a day, big. So we had a very nice tour. We asked if we'd go underground, and they said they really need kind of a week or 2 weeks advance, because going underground is a 2-3 hour operation going down, and you know, these mines, I've seen it in the deep mines, and one of them was, well, I can't think of the name. He said they have 35,000 men underground.
Oh, wow.
I mean, you know, we could lead at most, you know, may have had 1,200 or something years ago, 1,500 maybe. And 35,000 people underground. Getting them in and out is such a ordeal. So we never did. We didn't make it underground in the mine. I do remember seeing, you know, a lot of the workers in the mill were black in Pelabora, and I'm trying to think whether. Because I know I asked about relative pay, you know, did they have differential pay? They must have for the, you know, the miners. You couldn't have 35,000 people underground and pay them for very much money and stay in business, right?
That's
so I just don't recall how that was, but truck drivers and people in the mill, a lot of them were indeed black people, so they were using them in well trained operating jobs. I can tell you just a little bit about a couple other Australian ones that I'd like to mention. It was I'd been invited in 1969, I guess it was, to go to Australia for a UPAC, International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry meeting, and I was a plenary speaker. I gave a talk called Mineral Water Interfaces, I guess, and it was a main talk of the meeting, because you know, a lot of what I deal with is with surface phenomena, so afterwards, this was in Sydney, so afterwards I visited Melbourne and CSIRO, which has big flotation research facilities and grinding research and so on. And my friend Tom Healy, who was really behind my being invited, I think, to this UPAC meeting, said to send me up for the weekend to the Great Barrier Reef. And I decided, I thought about it a bit, and so the person who was the division head of the minerals division of CSIRO, the CSIRO is the big government research agency of Australia, there are many different laboratories. There's Commonwealth Industrial Scientific and something. It just goes big, those CSIRO. I can tell you what it is by looking it up. Anyway, here's this, Ivan Noonan was his name, and he acted as my travel agent. He said, oh, you don't want to go there. You want to go to Alice Springs. So I flew, and he arranged all that. We redid my trip, and so I flew to Broken Hill and had a day visiting different, didn't go in the mines, but mills. You know, Broken Hill is in, I guess, New South Wales, in the southwest corner. And I think that ore runs something like 25% lead, so, you know, plus silver. So it's a big union area. The unions can say a lot when you've got ore running 25%. But that Broken Hill is another place like Butte, you know, one of those, well, you know that. So that I remember visiting the, you know, it was the Zinc Corporation, and, you know, they had Broken Hill North, Broken Hill South. I think all of this, a lot of it became CRA, now Rio Tinto. But I had a very nice tour of the place, and then flew down to Adelaide, and then up to, I may have stayed overnight there, I don't remember, but flew up to Alice Springs. So I was at Alice Springs for a couple of days. That's a lovely spot, right dead center, and kind of an oasis. And
did you climb the...
Couldn't go to the Ayers Rock because I didn't have the time. Now, this was 69, and I was scheduled to give a talk at Mount Isa. And the only way to go was, there was a bush plane that flew only every 3 days or something. Mm-hmm. And maybe five of us were passengers on this plane that flew from Alice Springs to Mount Isa. And by the way, I was there that day, Saturday, and I think it was Saturday afternoon that I left, but Saturday morning they called it there's a dry river and runs through Alice Springs, and they called it Henley on the, whatever this dry river was, and they had I even saw this later on TV, they have shells, and they, and maybe little rails run, and they have races, you know, like shells for on the water. Only they're on the sand, and you know, they're paddling on the sand, and they're doing all these things like a regatta that takes place at Henley. Only it's on this dry river. But I saw that later on the TV in Sydney. So it's an annual thing. And anyway, this was. Pilot, I sat up in the front of this little airplane, and we flew about 3 hours, I guess, to Mount Isa at about 10,000 feet or something. You could just look down a little bit, you'd see what they call a station, or what they call a station, which is a ranch. You'd see one here, and after a while, you'd see one there, because it's such desert-like. And so anyway, I had spent the weekend and a couple more days in Mount Isa, and I gave a talk to their Australian Institute of Mining and Metallurgy meeting, and you know, toured the mill and so on. They had you know, that's copper, lead, zinc, I think all three of them. And then Mount Isa was owned by AS&R, then Mount Isa reversed it and bought them out. You know, ASNR just isn't anymore, as you know.
And, that's not cool.
And but that. Mount Isa is a town all by itself, a very obviously very good mine with good engineering staff, both for the mill and the mine. A lot of rock mechanics has been worked out there because apparently this is not my bag, but ground control is a problem, and so they needed good rock mechanics people to. For design of their mines and so on, but it's right out in the outback of Australia, and so anyway, I also on that trip I also visited well, it's 80 miles north of Sydney. Where BHP had the labs.
Queensland.
It's in Queensland, but right in the world is the name of the... It's right on the coast. I'll get the name. I hadn't thought of it ahead of time, but somebody named Tom Colcott was in charge of some of their processing research. And Colcott had a series of good papers on modeling comminution grinding when he was working for the coal board in England. And so I'd gotten to know him earlier, and he was working on processes for utilizing low-grade coal there. And I almost got the name of the place. It was a common name. And so I had a good, you know, technical visit in relation to that. Then maybe before we quit, one more item is in 83, my friend Tom Healy decided to organize a symposium in honor of Ian Warrick. Now, there are in flotation science of the 20s and 30s are three big names, which are Godin, with whom, as I have told you, I worked, a big man and good man, not quite the same stature, was Taggart at Columbia. And then Ian Warrick in Australia. And Warrick did tremendous amount of, for several years, study on the principles of sulfide mineral flotation. And mainly by using the measurement of contact angles. That's if you put an air bubble on a solid surface, and the air bubble adheres, you see a definite angle through the water, and that's called a contact. If you get your car waxed and you get a drop of water on it, okay, the angle through the water, you see this comes sharp, is a contact angle. Or on silverware, if you use soap, you see the water stand up that way.
Mm-hmm.
So he developed the procedure very accurately and to this day, his papers and figures, I use a lot of, you always see some of his stuff. So Warrick did this until, in the 30s up until about the 40s, so there's a tremendous series of papers. Then he had somebody named Sutherland work with him, Warrick wrote a book on flotation, and then the second edition is Sutherland and Warrick. Anyway, Warrick whether he founded or he became the overall director of CSIRO, I mean the whole works, and he was head of this, and Healy, and Wark was probably retired by then, had organized a symposium on flotation in his honor, and he invited me to be one of the plenary speakers. And this was held in Adelaide in 1983. I'd met Wark on that first trip, but just to shake hands. But I really got to know Wark then, Sir Ian. He was a sir by then. And I remember Healy saying, "Well, I know I'm going to have a hard time getting your paper, so I'm going to tape it." Well, he taped my talk, and I thought your tape talk was not, I use it only as a kind of the beginning. I wrote it when the volume came out. I've got a good paper in there, but it's no way to have a paper.
No.
But anyway, after that, we rode on a bus up to Broken Hill, which was a major annual meeting of their Australian AIME. Maybe it wasn't centennial, but it was a big number, a special meeting. Anyway, I remember we stopped and had lunch at a winery on the way up. I remember talking with Wark and his wife, and particularly with Wark, a lot on that bus ride up there. So I really got to know him at that time. And I gathered, but this part I didn't know, that he was a very ardent fly fisherman, and apparently a lot of flies are sold in Australia are Ian Wark flies. I mean, even he'd go by that.
Really?
That name, he tied his own. And at that time, I was already working, had a relationship with Homestay, and so I had arranged to go to Kalgoorlie. And so I flew from Broken Hill down to Adelaide, and the young man who was the accountant, he and I flew to Perth, and I remember meeting then somebody named Hugh Morgan, who was the manager of Western Mining out there. We spent an hour or two in his office, and he's now head of Western Mining, this man, Hugh Morgan. And then flew to Kalgoorlie, and Morgan, you know, at that time, Homestake owned half of the operations there, but 15%, I think, was owned by Western Mining, but they managed it. So I had a nice tour. I went underground in Mount Charlotte, which is a mine that you go down in a big truck, you sort of spiral down, and then they do a lot of drilling, and they blast once a year. They let everybody know, and I guess the whole town shook when that big blast went off. Until the mine is done, which it may be done by now, this is how mine, I don't know, some big ore body, and so you wound around the outside, and then they come in and do all this drilling and make this one big blast.
Oh.
and then pull ore out. But then it was, see, this was 83, and I stayed in the guest house of Western Mining, and the old guy, Sir, I hadn't planned on saying this, so I got the name slipping my mind, but I'll give you that. That had been maybe, I don't know if he'd been president of Western Mining, but he, if not vice president, he was totally behind the Crail Gurley School of Mines because he graduated from there. And so I had dinner with him. He and I were the only two guys in the guest house. And so I had a tremendous evening with, I'll give you his name. Mm-hmm. You probably even know the name. But it was quite an opportunity. But then the so-called Golden Mile was still there. All the thing was just a complete mass of headframes. And in Kalgoorlie, and they're all gone now, most of them, because that super pit has taken the land, is all gone. But but to me, that was a most interesting thing. And the mine that Homestake was involved with was really Mount Charlotte. The pit wasn't there or any of that, but that gave me an opportunity to see it back.
Now this was still an underground.
Was it? Oh, so it was underground, only underground. 1983, I added that, but the part to
was the Sons of Gwalia there.
Pardon me?
Sons of Gwalia, was that still there? I love that name.
I couldn't tell you, but I
think that was one of the...
There was a bar there that was a very famous...
No, the Sons of Gwalia was the mine that Hoover...
I saw the house that Hoover lived in, by the way. Somebody pointed that out. But there was a very famous bar that the... Dick Testula was the general manager. You know, he eventually became a Homestake employee, but he was a Western Mining manager way back, so that was almost 18 years ago. And it was 18 years ago. I remember afterwards we went to a bar, famous bar, that